Okay, so are we excited about the Yeti? Anyone who wants to try the costume on afterwards will make that available as well. You can see the pain of being dressed like the Yeti. My goal is for you to see how easy it is to write games with JavaScript and HTML5. So later on I'm going to go into some of the different options you have with game engines to get more complex. I'm going to show you a bunch of HTML5 games that are already in the store, probably games that you didn't even know were written in HTML5. But for this session, I want to just continue to take those building blocks that we have and put them together and form our game. So talk about the swag for a minute. Now, the last time we gave away swag for asking questions, the first question was, how old am I? And first of all, I'm not going to tell you how old I am. And that's not, that's not really the kind of questions that I'm looking for. So I am excited about giving this stuff out, though. So hopefully we get some good questions generated and stuff like that. And not every question will get a swag, right? But we'll do our very best. All right, so starting back with the Yeti. Let's do a little bit of an overview of what we have here. So we took our canvas, right, and we drew our mountain on top of it and our hiker on top of it. So we had the different elements that we were drawing on the canvas. And then our canvas was seated inside of the DOM, right? So we had a very basic DOM with the canvas inside of it. And then we showed in the initial game the elements on the page that we use for controls as well, right? We had our snowball button, and we had our left and right button, and that's how we use to control. What we're gonna do this point going forward is we're gonna take the skills we know about drawing on the canvas, and then what we know about doing updates to the logic in our game cycle. And then we're gonna add in some factors like collision, and then we're gonna add some keyboard controls as well to this. So that we take our ability to draw into a canvas and turn it into a full-fledged Yeti game. Now, the one thing that we hadn't done yet is we haven't actually laid out our background. So we're going to start with the very last sample that I showed you before, with us drawing the hiker going up the mountain. And I'm going to add this CSS to the page. So remember, I told you that the canvas is transparent. So anything that you put on the background behind the canvas, you're going to see through the canvas to it. So in this case, we're going to put an image tiled on the background. And when we throw our canvas on top of it, we have something that looks like this. So you can see I still have the black line there, so you can see where the canvas starts and ends, and once our hiker drawing position is off the side of the canvas, he's no longer drawn there, and the cloud background shows through. So the clouds are going to stay the same. We have them as just a background image on our body, and then our canvas tag is going to be placed right on top of that. So that's something to keep in mind when you draw your, when you're building your game. If you have some static information on the page, if you have static images, you can just make that part of either your background of your page, or throw in a couple DOM elements and put images as backgrounds of them, or actually include images if you want. So if there are things that don't change on the page, you don't actually need to put them into the DOM. Okay, now, what we've seen so far is we've seen our hiker walking up the path and then off the side of the mountain. What we need to do is we need to give him a little bit of bounds for him to stay inside of. So we need to add a little bit of logic to the hiker's path. So instead of just adding one pixel up and three pixels over for the hiker, we actually want to update that logic. So once he hits the one side of the mountain, he then turns around and goes to the other side of the mountain. So in order to do this, we're going to add a little bit of logic to the values that we started with for our hiker's position. So remember, I started out with some plain values, 1,000 and 500, which drew him right at the bottom of the path on the mountain. And then we just continued through our update cycle to update those values. Well, we need some logic to tell it that once he goes so far on the mountain, he needs to change directions and go the other way. Well, and remember, the mountain kind of goes up like as an upside down cone, right, as most mountains do. And so we can't just tell him to turn around at a certain position based on how high he is in the mountain. We're going to have him turn around at different spots. So we started out with this, and we have the hiker left and the hiker top values. And then we have a check here. And the first thing we're doing is seeing if he's reached the outer limits of the mountain, then we're going to have him turn around. So we've already specified in our code, this is the outer limit. And we have him turn around by multiplying whatever value he is by -1. All right, so that just turns his positives into negatives. That way, if he's -1 and you multiply it by -1, what do you get?
Positive 1.
Gears of War. What's that? All right, here you go. I was hoping somebody would know that. I mean, this is our IT, right? So we multiply it by -1. That way, if it's a positive, it turns negative. If it's a negative, it turns positive. And then as the hiker goes up the mountains, so his top position gets smaller, we know he's going higher in the mountain, we can bring in those sides a little bit. So every time he goes up, his path gets a little shorter. And at the very end, you can see in the bottom of the screen here, I have just a little bit of logic that if he makes it all the way to the top, he just does a little dance. The evil hiker dance. So you can see, he reaches a certain point, and although he's not following the path, I just have basic logic, because I want you to kind of see how he stays inside of the cone, changes direction every time he reaches the outer limit, until he gets to the start, the top, and then he has one. He does his little dance there. So it's pretty simple logic. And you can imagine this is something that if you're building levels of a game, you might want to extract this out. Because the path information for your hiker, if you have different levels that have different paths, you may want him to go different directions. So this is something that you could extract out and turn into your level data so that on every level, as his path changes, this data would change as well.
Yeah. For the actual numbers for like position, is that relative to the original images or the canvas size, or?
That's a great question. So his question was, are the numbers that I'm using based on the original position of the images, or on its last position, or the canvas size? And they're always going to be related to the canvas. So think of it like remember, go back to the battleship strategy, right? We're always going to go from the top left-hand corner. So as we change the position of the hiker, he's going to be drawn from that top left-hand corner. So it'll always be the number of pixels down, the number of pixels over from the top left. Okay, now it's time to add in the Yeti, who is really the hero of our game here, right? So I don't want my Yeti to be stagnant, right? I need to give him a little bit of life. So he's going to be moving his arms around. And in order to do this Yeti animation, I'm going to use what we call a sprite, an image sprite. Has anyone heard of an image sprite before? Okay, good. So I know this is a popular concept in games, and it's actually something that in the CSS world, we've taken that concept from the game world, and we use it a lot in CSS, where we compile these images together into one image. And so what we have here is we have one image of a hiker, of a Yeti, and he has different positions of the Yeti on different sections of the image. So what we're going to do is we're going to then go and grab a different section of the image, and in every time we change frames, we'll play a different section of the image. So that way it gives the impression that his arms are moving, okay? Because we're going to be drawing just a different section of this sprite every time. Now, I'm going to try to break this down because this is probably the most complex part of the game that we have here today. So remember before we started and we loaded two images, and we needed to know when those images loaded so that we knew when to start drawing them onto the canvas. So in order to do that, we're going to start with another image. Okay, so we're going to add a Yeti image to our game, and we're going to assign that variable called Yeti to a new image. And then we're going to add another loader. Remember, we already have in place a loader for the mountain and a loader for the hiker. So now we're going to add another loader for the Yeti. So we're adding an event listener for the Yeti, so that way we know once the image data is loaded into this image, we know that it's ready, it fires the load event, and we can then go and update the asset count. Now before, we had two assets. We had a hiker and a mountain, so our asset count that we were looking for was two. Now that we're adding a new third image in there, a third asset, we're going to be upping our asset count to three. So we're looking in our method, once the asset count reaches three, we know we're good to go, and we're going to fire off the draw method. Now, in our draw method, we have added in a new function called drawYeti, and then we've also added a frame rate tracker. So in this case, we need to keep track of what frame we're on. And we're going to start with zero, and every time we draw another cycle, we're going to update that frame. And we're going to use that in our sprite. Okay, so this is our draw Yeti function. And there's a couple things that we're doing here, so I want to walk through it. The first thing that we're going to do is we want our Yeti to be sideways on the mountain. You know, when we look at the image that we started with, the Yeti is up straight. But in this case, we want to draw him sideways. So instead of turning the image, we're actually going to turn the context of the canvas. So we're basically going to be shifting the context of the canvas, drawing the image on it, and then shifting the context back. So since the context is our drawing surface, it'd be like us shifting the drawing surface to draw him on, and then shift it back when we're done. So we're going to rotate it 45 degrees. And then we do a draw image, and inside of that draw image, we're adding a little bit of logic. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take that frame rate that we had, and we're going to divide it by 6, because every frame, we want to draw a different section of the Yeti image, and there's going to be 6 different Yetis on the same image. And then we're going to do the image height divided by 6. And then for the size of the image that we want to draw, we want it to be the same size as the image we brought in, which is why we're doing the Yeti.width and the Yeti.height, because that's going to refer to the image. So we're going to pull in that same width and height. The height, we're going to divide by 6, because again, there's going to be 6 Yetis on there. And it might help if I actually show you what that looks like. Okay, so this is our Yeti here, and you notice he's drawn over and over again with his arms in a slightly different position. Okay. So we're going to, since he's lined up one on top of another, that's why we take the height and divide it by 6. Question?
For the rotate function, you have like 0.45 there. So what parameter is that taking? Are all like degrees showed by decimal?
So that's a good question. It's actually a full rotation. I did say 45 degrees, didn't I? But actually, one would be an entire rotation. So this is going to be 0.45, which is a little less than half of a rotation there. So it's going to be a fraction of one you're going to use for that.
When you rotate the canvas, you've already drawn something, it doesn't rotate that image. It just rotates the orientation of the canvas itself.
Exactly. So it's going to rotate the orientation of the drawing surface, which allows me to draw my Yeti straight, and then when I rotate it back, it appears that he was drawn at an angle.
So where is the pivot point for that rotation? Is it the top left corner? Is it the origin?
So it's going to be from the center.
Okay.
So it would be a full rotation would be completely upside down. All
right.
Yes?
Does the canvas currently allow you to change the original rotation?
To change the original rotation.
The origin rotation,
like the point of the axis
rotate. That's a great question. I don't believe so. I can look that up to be sure.
If anyone's proposed adding it to the fact.
That's also a great question. That's a great question. That deserves a game, right? Here's a war. Not that I want you guys to try to stump me, but.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's the drawing is very simple. When we rotate the canvas, draw them on straight, and rotate it back. So a lot of times you can bring your image data in the direction you want, but in this case, you may be using your Yeti in different positions, so you don't want to have to have images for every different position that you might be in. Question?
From what I saw from Google, it says you actually have to just move. You can't actually change the origin. So if you wanted to get a different sort of thing, you have to move the canvas itself.
Move the canvas itself.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you can translate the canvas to a different position. So
it's always away.
There you go. Cannot move the orientation. Okay, so inside the draw, we're looking at inside the draw, so we're going to be drawing the Yeti's width, Yeti height divided by 6, and then the negative 50-50 is going to put him on the right position within the canvas, and then again, we want him to be the same size that he came in as. We're not going to scale that image any, so again, we're going to use the Yeti width and the Yeti height divided by 6. So let me show you what that's going to look like in action. Okay, so now we have our hiker climbing the mountain, and we have our angry Yeti at the top shaking his arms because he's angry. So all we're doing is every frame, we're going to a different position of the image. So position 1, position 2, through all the way through 6 for that. And then since we're dividing the frame number, once it gets to position 6, it goes back to 1. Okay, so we have our Yeti, we have our hiker, and we have the path. So one of the big things that we're missing is any real action in our game, right? We've got to arm our Yeti with his snowballs so that he can get back at these hikers. And the big thing that we need to test is whether the snowball is actually colliding with the hiker. So in order to do this, this part is always a lot easier than I think it's going to be. We need to run a test to see whether there's collision between these two entities, right? We've got our snowball, we've got a hiker. We need to see if they're colliding. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the images that we're drawing there and the position that we drew them at. So this is actually going to be from the top left-hand corner of that image. The position that we last drew it at, and then we're going to test the position that we last drew the other image at, so position we last drew the hiker versus the position that we last drew the snowball, and then draw a radius around it. And if those two radiuses overlap, we know that those two entities have collided. If they're not overlapping, we know that they have not collided. So we're not actually testing the images on the canvas. So the only, we're not actually keeping track of where the images are on the canvas. We're keeping track of the last place that we drew them. So since we knew the last place that we drew them, every time we go through our cycle, in the update section of that cycle, we test those positions and see if the radiuses overlap. And that's how we know whether they've collided or they haven't collided. So the logic for this is going to be pretty simple. So first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to draw my snowball. And again, for this snowball, since he's going to be another entity that we're adding, another image that we're adding, remember we've got to up our asset count to 4, do a new image for the snowball, and then add a new loading method for the snowball. And once we have our snowball on there, instead of drawing him directly, we're going to call this function called draw snowball, and we'll draw the snowball there. And then what I'm doing with the top is I want to give a little bit of momentum to the snowball so that as it drops, it starts moving a little faster. So I'm actually just using the position that it is from the top of the screen and adding that to adding that divided by 50 to itself. So I'm adding 1/50th of that distance to the distance of the snowball from the top. That way it accelerates, since the number is going to get bigger of where it is drawn from the top, so will the number that I add to it. So that way as it moves down, it'll go faster and faster. And I think it'll be easier to see that than know it from looking at the code. Question?
Is there any way to declare constants, or can we only have pointers?
So in JavaScript, everything that you declare is going to be a variable.
Okay.
So what we do in JavaScript is we generally have constants as more of a pattern than we do by any enforced method. So in this case, if you notice, my pattern has always been to keep all of my variables at the top. And that's a real easy way to track it, similar to you would if you had an external constant. I could easily have an external constant where I had a different JavaScript file that declared all my constants. And then I would just reference those same variables. Since they're all going to be in the same scope, it doesn't matter which JavaScript file I have them in. But that's something I would recommend for you to do as a pattern when you're developing in JavaScript, but not enforced.
One small thing. Technically, it's not generally used because it's a pain and not usually worth it. But if you have if you're creating a JavaScript class, you can use object.defineProperty. And among other things, that does let you control whether a variable can be rewritten. So in that way, you can sort of end up with a constant. It's just not even close to as simple as just creating a final variable would be in another language.
Okay. So was that you're just telling us, right?
I'm responding to the question that yes, you can sort of create a constant in JavaScript. It's just not as straightforward and generally not used.
Yeah. And there's also different levels of support of versions of ECMAScript that support that. However, there's libraries out there that can help you. One that Microsoft had created and then open source is called TypeScript. And TypeScript is very good at allowing you to fix your variable types and things like that as a way to help you control them.
Not to like backtrack too much, but do you know if it's possible to do pixel perfect collision in HTML5?
To do pixel perfect collision. So yes, because you can draw out in pixels if you want to. So if you had an image that literally need to be pixel perfect, whereas it's not a square or a radius isn't good enough, you could, but that would actually force you to have a good understanding of the actual pixel data, which means you might need to have a separate record of pixel data on your image, or you may be drawing out pixel per pixel. So if I had a spaceship and I was just drawing the spaceship, I can draw it directly on the canvas with pixels, and then I would have a pure pixel record of that entity. And in that case, I actually could do pixel perfect.
So there's no function in JavaScript to interrogate an image and get the alpha value of a pixel?
So in...
Because that's what how you guys are doing in XNA and stuff, right? Is you...
You do
box collision first, and then if they do overlap, then you do your pixel collision by looking at the alpha layer.
So you can look at the alpha layer in a in the canvas. So once you pull your image data into the canvas, you can actually read each of those pixels. I'll tell you just from my experience with performance across browsers, it's a lot more expensive to read pixels than to write pixels. So that's kind of why I would recommend keeping a record of the pixels rather than reading them off. And if you did want to read off, I would then recommend having a separate canvas that you use to read data and to write. But yeah, that's a very good point as far as having consistency with what you're already comfortable with. So there's ways to do it. And it would really be about optimizing performance that would help you determine which way to do that. Great question.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're drawing our snowball, making it go faster as we go. The last thing we have on here is at some point we're going to determine that you as the Yeti have either won or lost. So we're going to have a win state, and if it's in the win state, we don't need to draw snowballs anymore. So that's where I'm going to start to introduce this idea of a win state, where we're going to determine that if we're not in the win state, we can go ahead and draw a new snowball at the top. If we've already won, there's no need to draw it. Okay, so let's take a look at this. So what I have here is I have a hiker, and I have images, and there's no detection here. So what we're seeing is we just will see the hiker and the snowball overlap, because I'm not doing anything to determine that there's been a collision. Now we'll add in that code, which I don't think I have shown you yet. So we need to test that collision. As we draw the snowball, we're going to, inside of this function for drawing the snowball, we'll make that test. That way, since this runs every cycle, we'll be able to tell every cycle whether we've had a collision or not. So it's fairly simple logic that we're going to add in this new function called test collision. And inside of test collision, we're going to just take the absolute position of both the hiker and the snowball. And if it is less than 50, then we know that those two have overlapped, okay? So we're really just taking the position of their tops and the position of their lefts. And if it has met both of those conditions, that they're closer to 50 pixels together from the top, and they're closer to 50 pixels together from the left, then we consider that a collision. And we fire our win state to be true. So that means that the Yeti has won. So let's see that in action. So he comes close, but he hasn't hit him. Then here, he hits him right on, and it fires that win state. And if you remember back when we drew the hiker, we added the little dance for him when he won. So we're going to have him make his stop and do his little dance there as well. Okay, so now we have the Yeti. He's armed with a snowball, and we know when that snowball has hit the hiker. So the one thing that we haven't done is we haven't actually given our users a way to control the snowball. So we're in our simple version here, we're going to add some keyboard controls that allows our user to be able to make the snowball go left or make the snowball go right as it drops. So what we're going to do is we're going to add an event listener to our keys. So in this case, the event that we're listening for is going to be a key down. So there are many keys on my keyboard, so I need to be able to tell which key exactly it was that was pressed. So whenever we have an event listener attached, when that event fires, it passes in an event object. And inside of that event object, when a key was hit, is an attribute called key code. So we're going to look to see if the key code was either 37 or 39. And 37 is going to be our left key, and 39 is going to be our right key. Now, it could have been any key that was hit on the keyboard that fired this key code, and they're all going to have a different number associated with them. And if it's not a 37 or a 39, we're just ignoring it. So we'll keep a record of the key direction based on the key code that was hit. And then inside of our snowball method, we're going to add this code here. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to add 6 pixels to the snowball left if it was right, the right key that was hit. And we're going to add 6 pixels, we're going to subtract 6 pixels from the snowball left if it was the left key that was hit. Okay? So every frame that is drawn, it'll go 6 more pixels to the left or 6 more pixels to the right. Okay, so we're using key codes to keep track of that. That way, every frame will reference that. So instead of just going 6 pixels with every one key, it will continue to move 6 pixels farther every time. So that way, it kind of gives it a little bit of, a natural behavior that it would have there, add a little bit of physics to it. Question?
I'm going to assume that there are key codes for controllers. Like if I was to make this for Windows 8, I'd let it be
an That is a great question. His question was, can I assume there's not key codes for controllers? Did you get a prize yet?
No.
Okay. We're going to touch on that a little bit, how to get a hold of controller codes. But in the web frame, there is no data that pulls in that way.
So, but if I wanted to make it for Windows 8, the service tablet, you can plug in an Xbox 360 controller.
Yes, you can plug in an Xbox 360 controller, and I'll show you that. But we will address that, and it's that's another reason to build an app as opposed to just a web app.
There's actually a gamepad API, and you can craft it in the web framework without having to have it built for Windows or anything like that. I know it works in Chrome, and I believe it's implemented in Firefox as well now. It's going
much quicker. Yeah. Stable, but they're definitely working on it.
Yes. So there is an upcoming standard for it that is not yet implemented across the board.
Well, 90% of it is implemented across the board. Big pieces of work.
Okay. Good. I'll take your word for that. I think you know more about that than I do, but. No more questions from the troublemakers there? No, I'm just kidding. Ask all the questions you want. I'm glad to not be stumped. Did you get a game yet? There you go. You want, sure, what else I have? Halo?
Sure.
I know you guys probably already have all these games anyway. You're going to sell them on eBay. But either way. Okay, so back to the snowball. So we're going to be taking our snowball and we're going to be using our key controls for now and only using our left and right keys for that. Now the one thing I have at the bottom is I am going to reset the key every time I draw a new snowball because that way, the new snowball doesn't start going the same direction the last snowball went. We want to kind of reset it every time it gets to the top. So to show what that's going to look like, now I actually have the ability to control my snowballs there and get him hit with the hiker. It'd probably be better if I didn't move it at all. There we go. So now your user has some control over the game. So this again is going to contribute to the logic part of the game. So during the update cycle of the game, we want to be reading the inputs from the user, and then the draw part of the cycle, we're going to want to be taking that information and using it to determine where we're going to draw the hiker.
In Australia, you can use two different canvases to create like levels of things. Can you actually do collision between objects within canvases, within separate canvases, or would it only work between one?
The way that we're doing it, you absolutely can. And what you would do, if you have two different canvases and you're drawing that, you're still going to have record in JavaScript of the last place you drew those. So you'll do a comparison on the record level. I'm sorry, I didn't repeat the question. The question was, if you're using two different canvases, can you test collision between those canvases? You can, and that since we're doing it with the at the JavaScript level, we're testing our you know record of the last place that we drew them, you absolutely can do that. Okay, so in the original version of the game I showed you, it also had touch controls, and that's something that you are going to want to be more and more sensitive to as we move forward in this world of touchscreen inputs. So you're going to have users who have a device like this, or even the laptop that I'm using today is a touchscreen laptop as well. So here, your users are going to have the ability to use a keyboard and mouse or a touchscreen. And I may want to start out playing my game using the mouse or the keyboard and then switch to the touchscreen at some point. So it's important that you have controls that work not on mouse or touch, but touch and mouse. There is a new specification in the W3C to handle this, and we've got it implemented in IE10 and inside of the Windows 8 development environment, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But it's called pointers, and again you'll see the MS pointer here because it is a specification that is not final yet, so it's an experimental build. And what we're able to do with that is a pointer is able to determine where on the screen something was done, whether it was done with a mouse, with a stylus, or with a touch screen. So I have these controls on the screen here. I can be hitting the snowball with my mouse, or I can be hitting it with my finger. It'll support all of those things, and you as a developer don't need to write for each case. Every case is going to be handled. But you do want to make sure that you have controls for every scenario that you're going to support. And on the web, you may have some devices that have touch screens but don't have keyboards. You may have some devices that have keyboards but don't have touch screens, or devices that have both. So you want to make sure that you support that. Okay, and here I'm doing a test to see if it is MS pointer enabled. That way I know if it's using pointers, I can support them. Otherwise, I'll fall back to a click. In that case. All right. When your game gets a little bit more complex, you're going to need to be careful about how you're managing your code. So one of the recommendations that I'm going to make is as you're building your game that you actually manage based on an entity. So I've talked a lot about entities as far as a hiker being one entity and the mountain being a separate entity and the snowball being another entity. When you create, and in this case we created an image, right? And we use the image to directly pull the data from, and then within that, the method associated with the image, we drew it out based on separate variables that were called hiker top and hiker left. Well, as you get more complex, it makes more sense to manage those as objects. So in JavaScript, you can create an object. I can have an object that's called a hiker, and then inside of that object, I can have a property called height, and a property called width, and a property called image data. And that way, whenever I'm working with entities, it'll be very clear to me where I'm going to pull that data from, and it's going to be consistent no matter what I'm working with, because it was consistent the way that I wrote it. So in this case, we have hikers. We have three hikers on the screen. They all have different image data associated with them. They all have a different velocity associated with them, how quickly they're hiking up the mountain. And they all have a different position associated with them. But it's going to be easy for us to work with these hikers because we're going to have consistency from one hiker to another as to where we're going to read that data. So it might look something like this. In this case, I have a hiker, and then inside of the hiker data, I'm going to be putting the image path, the image itself, its position, and its velocity. Now, another thing that we did not put in our sample game here, but is audio. It's generally a lot more fun to interact with a game whenever you're using audio and visual. So inside of HTML, we have the ability to create audio tags. And in this case, I have a simple MP3 of the collision every time that a hiker's path crosses over with a snowball's path, and it makes the sound of the hiker falling to his death. Question?
Can you put the stream schema address into a different separate JavaScript file so it's easier to manage?
Put the what?
Put the script schema class in a different JavaScript file.
Yes, you can. And again, that would definitely be something I would recommend. In order to manage your code easier, I could take each of these different concepts. Maybe one would be collision, and I can have my collision code written in one JavaScript file. And then maybe I would have my draw code that would draw my different entities in another JavaScript file. In JavaScript, you have a lot of control over how you manage objects, and you can encapsulate an object into its own scope, but by default, the scope of all objects are going to be on the page. What we call the window is the scope of them. So it doesn't matter which JavaScript file the code comes from, it's all going to have access to the variables at its level. So that means inside of functions, when you declare variables, those variables are only available inside of those functions. Variables that you declare outside of functions are going to be accessible by any function. So that gives you the ability to manage your code different ways. Now, it's also important that we talk about performance whenever we're talking about games. And I feel like it used to be easier because we used to write for one single device. You know, we used to write for an Xbox, or we used to write for a tablet, or we used to write for a desktop. But at this point, and especially whenever you're delivering your content over the web, you don't know what kind of device, and there's a whole range of devices that your code could be ran on. I could be playing this game on my Xbox at home. I could be playing this game on my Surface at work when I'm supposed to be doing my work. You never know. So you want to make sure that your game can handle that your game can perform well no matter what device it's running on. So we have a couple tips here. One of the things that you can do is only draw what you need. So we talked about in our game how I didn't need to redraw the sky every time. So the sky was not even part of the canvas itself. It was a background image that was on the body, never had to interact with page. Now, likewise, you may only need to be redrawing one section of your canvas. Sometimes that'll give you better performance by reducing the amount of the canvas that you're redrawing every time. So many times, only draw what you need. If you don't need to redraw something every time, don't redraw it every time.
One question. Since we're talking about performance, this is actually something that I've been wanting to know for a while. I'm not entirely sure if there are any optimizations on the JavaScript end of things. When you do something like Flash game, right? Flash compiles into a virtual machine, right? So Python is a
about passive that you can interpret the code. I haven't done JavaScript for a while, so I don't know if JavaScript continues to be an interpreted language or if there is some kind of just-in-time compilation going on, or if it depends on the browser. So the
question was, based on performance, since it's not a virtual machine that runs machine-level code,
yeah.
You know, is JavaScript an interpreted language? And it is an interpreted language. So actually the answer to all three of those is yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
It is interpreted language. It is JIT. So it is, there is just-in-time compiling going on. And I don't remember what the third question was, but the answer is yes. The answer is, is it different for browser to browser? That was it. And yeah. It is going to be different for browser to browser. So different browsers are going to have different strengths in drawing areas. So I'm using Internet Explorer 10, which has a lot of hardware acceleration built into it, especially in the area of Canvas.
Yeah.
So in Internet Explorer 10, the development team hardware accelerates whenever they can. So it's not a matter of turning on hardware acceleration. If it can be hardware accelerated, they do it. So if they can JIT it, they do.
So what about regular code? I mean, stuff like map. I'm not entirely sure if regular day-to-day code is going to be accelerated in some way. One of the things that I haven't seen is something like this engine implemented in JavaScript, something like HostGPT. Or it's like, how it's going to compare in performance to, Flash or maybe Unity. So, I don't know, and the reason why I'm asking that question is because that actually puts a very hard limit on the complexity of the games that you can make.
Yeah. So, when determining, is JavaScript going to be just as fast as, as actual native code, and the answer is it depends on what you do, because there are plenty of things that you can do with JavaScript that can be hardware accelerated and will run just as smooth, just as well as if it were written in a native language. But there are many times that you should go to a native language for different types of things. And we'll talk a little bit about that in an upcoming session and when we talk about how to mix languages. But there's definitely limitations. The good news is JavaScript can cover a lot of our needs in games. And I'm going to do some demos of some different games, and you can see how they perform there. So we found a lot of our partners, a lot of companies, want to use web technologies, and they want to use JavaScript whenever they can. So if they don't need native language, they don't write it in native. And the reason is for the portability. So JavaScript runs a lot of places, mm-hmm. Not only in browsers, but in web views as a native application in Windows 8 and other platforms. So there's a lot that you can do. Okay. Go ahead.
Just real quick, I did find BoxDB.js.
There is an implementation. I was just wondering about the performance. It's actually pretty good.
Okay, reuse objects whenever you can. If you're using an image or an audio file over and over again, you don't want to load it and then pull it out of the DOM. If you're not going to use it again, get rid of it, delete it. But if you think you're going to use it again, keep it there so that you're not recreating it. In JavaScript, every time you add something new to the DOM, you're triggering some garbage collection, or every time you remove it from the DOM, trigger some garbage collection. So the less adding and removing of assets that you have, generally the better. But you don't want to take that too far to the point where you're loading a bunch of assets up front that you never use. Only passing integers to the Canvas Draw API. There's really no such thing as 1.5 pixels. So a pixel is as small as it can get. So whenever you're drawing on your Canvas, JavaScript and Canvas will absolutely take decimal place integers. But you're really just kind of wasting some CPU cycling by doing that. It's much better in JavaScript to round those off to whole integers so that you're actually passing in something that you can use.
tiering it out, we are drawing a tiering, we are managing the arrays in JavaScript, but we also have scalable vector graphics. In SVG, the basic elements we have, anime, it's actually, it's much more easier to use, it's basically tag oriented, even the anime, only thing that would be more before we are actually working games.
So there's definitely, SVG and Canvas are not the same thing. So the question was, is SVG maybe a better implementation?
SVG is part of
HTML5. It's part of HTML5, right. But it's different than the Canvas. So there is a place for both of them. And there's absolutely areas where SVG is going to make more sense and places where Canvas is going to make more sense. In this case, when we're handling redrawing of a set, you know, like of a scenario, I would highly recommend Canvas for this. This is what it's built for drawing out image data and things like that. But if you're doing things with, you know, with actual manipulation of objects, a lot of times SVG is going to perform a lot better for that because there's things that it's made for as well. So they're both options, and depending on the scenario and the type of game or the type of app that you're building, you want to make sure you choose the right one, because at this point, when you're doing something really simple, it might not matter, but as you add complexity, having the right drawing language is going to make a big difference. Another thing with audio, make sure that you're not including audio that you're not going to use. A lot of times audio can take up a lot more space. Remember, you are inside of a browser window here, so you're going to have a limit to the amount of memory that you're going to have available, and then has to be shared between your audio files, your images, and the JavaScript that's running as well. So read as little as possible. That's something that we brought up a little earlier. It's a lot quicker to write than it is to read. Read has to be done by the CPU. Write can generally be done with the GPU. Using image data, it's a lot easier to pull data from an image than to draw it out pixel for pixel. So whenever you can use image data, do that. And then test. And never say enough how important it is that if you plan on having your game run on a myriad of devices, you need to make sure that you're testing on a myriad of devices as well. So that everything everything that your users might use, you know how your game's gonna run that. So we're hard up against the break here. One last thing I want to throw in there to help you test. There is a website called modern.ie, and it's something that Microsoft has put together for web developers who are building web-based apps. And it's there to make sure that your site works in modern browsers. It'll run tests for you to tell you what you might be able to change. It gives you a free account to Browser Stack, which is an environment for you to be able to test on virtual machines of all of the different browsers. That's going to include your mobile browsers, IE10 if you don't have access to that, IE9, you know, iOS browsers, and all those type of things are there in Browser Stack. Tips for developing better experience for your users, and then some extra tools like virtual machines and stuff like that to make life for you easier. So that's modern.ie. We're going to take a break of 20 minutes, right? Sound good? And we've got some snacks there. I'm going to hang out here. I know some of you guys have questions still, so you can feel free to bring those to me while we're here. But everyone get some snacks, some drinks, and we'll be back at 20 after.